Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, in the last half century, just three people have gone from being leader of the opposition to prime minister. Today we take a look at what happened 45 years ago this week, when Margaret Thatcher became one of them, speaking to the people who knew her best. A really fascinating insight into the politics, the policies, and the people that helped her change almost everything about her in order to become Prime Minister in 1979. And before that, in The Columnist, Manvin Rana and Matthew Paris on whether the future of the union looks safer as the SNP descend into chaos. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app at Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Happy local elections day to those who celebrate, and happy First Minister in Crisis to everyone else. And a very good morning to the New York Times, who've come up with a brilliant idea of speaking to politicians who are standing down at the next election.
This year is my 58th consecutive year as an elected official.
I never planned on doing it for more than just a few years. Now we're going on 28 years.
I knew it was time to leave about 3 weeks after I got to Congress. It just took me a long time to try to figure out how to get out of this place.
Why didn't we think of this? Speaking to more than 100, some of the more than 100 MPs who've announced they're quitting. Got an idea? Joe Check, of course. You can find our exit interviews right now. Just search on the Politics Out the Boring Bits podcast. Now.
Manveen Rana and someone called Matthew on Times Radio.
Yes, Manveen Rana is here. Hello, Manveen.
Hello.
Matthew Paris is here. Hello, Matthew.
And the most important guest, the cake.
The cake is here. Some breaking news on Times Radio.
Oh my God.
After, I'll be honest, quite a fallow period.
I'm sorry. I feel like I've let the side down.
Manveen has delivered the goods, and on my request. It's still warm.
I took it out of the oven half an hour ago and bolted over across London with
it. So just explain what this delicious thing is.
This is raspberry and amaretti cake, as requested.
Oh, so good.
I hope it's right. I mean, I just had to take it out of the oven whenever I had to run, so it still might be a bit...
No, it's crunch on the top and very warm and gooey in the middle.
Well, we felt the tin that it came in, and it had a warm
scorching
bottom.
Scorching my lap on the way.
It's nothing like warm bottom on a Thursday morning.
We have turned very bake-off in here.
We've all felt the warm bottom, and we were very excited about it.
Oh, God, they're going to take us off air.
If only. Anyway, while we dig into the cake, we can have a listen, because literally in the last few moments, Scotland's longest-serving Deputy First Minister, John Swinney, has launched his SNP leadership bid.
Thank you for joining me at the Grassmarket Community Project, a venture that brings hope to some of the most vulnerable people in our society in the setting of a social enterprise. This place reflects my values, who I am, and it's therefore the right place for me to confirm that I intend to stand for election as leader of the Scottish National Party. I want to build on the work of the SNP government to create a modern, diverse, dynamic Scotland that will ensure opportunity for all of her citizens. I want to unite the SNP and unite Scotland for independence.
So that is the John Swinney launching his leadership bid for the SNP with the slogan, Unite for Independence. Do you think that's going to work, Matthew?
I suppose you don't have to have hair to be in politics, do you? it'll probably...
It's an interesting question, though. When was the last time...
Well, Churchill didn't have much hair.
No.
That's true.
That's the last one.
I think it is.
Yes, has our attitude to hair changed since then, though?
Mm.
Can we have a bold...
I don't know. Well, Willem Hague, I suppose, was the next one. It didn't work out.
Very successful.
Can we even say bold anymore? Out. I don't know.
Follically challenged.
I feel like this is why you're here, Matthew, to zero in on the thing that people won't have thought about but now will become obsessed with.
I know. I mean, there have genuinely been studies done on hairstyles and whether they win an election, how much of a difference that makes. And so Blair, I remember, sort of got his hair cut at one point, and people went mad because sophologists have studied this and apparently it does have an impact. So if hairstyle has an impact, then presumably being bald would too.
I hadn't really thought of this. But Neil Kinnock didn't do him any good, did it? Didn't do William Hague any good?
No.
Well, I think they need to think.
They need to consider this. On the substance, what he's basically trying to do is put together the ragtag coalition of people in Scotland who don't agree on very much apart from independence. And so unite for independence is the like, don't worry about all the other stuff. We'll stop talking about trans things. We'll stop talking about green things. We'll stop, you know, we'll just talk about independence.
That's sort of the problem, though, isn't it? I mean, the SNP has been such an odd party for a very long time. You know, they started off with, like, the tartan Tories and anyone who was pro-independence. But in the meantime, under that label, they've sort of become very, very left-wing, very sort of progressive and liberal. And that doesn't bring all of the party with them. But actually, I mean, the party doesn't seem to like Kate Forbes much for exactly that reason, because it is, you know, she is anti sort of slightly woke, and you know, her values aren't sort of in line with the Nicola Sturgeon agenda. So the SNP don't seem to like her, but she's doing better in terms of polls with the rest of the country. So maybe they're not broad enough for a coalition. I don't know. I think as a party, it doesn't feel very sustainable.
And you wrote in the Times this week, Matthew, you're launching Gays for Kate Forbes. Explain that.
Well, you know, they say she's homophobic. I see no evidence of that. She belongs to a church. She's a keen churchgoer, and she said that she wouldn't have voted for gay marriage. A lot of people didn't vote for gay marriage. You can have your own views on gay marriage, and I don't think that we gays should be whimpering like victims any longer. We've won all these battles. She has said that she would never revisit the legislation. Fine, let's draw a line under it. Is she going to be a good leader of the party? And there's every evidence that she has what so many people in Scottish politics seem to lack, which is basic competence in administration.
Well, indeed, in any politics.
Yes.
I remember because she was very young when she first became the finance minister.
She still is.
And then she's a great communicator. I remember sort of first hearing on some panel shows and interviews and that sort of thing. And you thought she did have that. She appeared to have the thing that lots of people don't. That when they're speaking, you sort of sit up and take notes. You sort of slightly turn up the dial rather than turning it down.
And she's, you know, she's very smart. I met her a few months ago, and you know, she's a lovely person, very smart. I think because of that, and because people sort of sit up and listen to what she's saying, they're often surprised by her views, just because you don't often hear them expressed in modern politics. You know, she is quite old-fashioned in a lot of her opinions, I guess. You know, I think she was brought up by missionaries. She's, you know, very much guided by her religion, which I think, again, people find it awkward to talk about in modern politics. So I think people don't know what to make of her, but she clearly has something about her which makes her quite a successful politician. She's just finding her constituency, I think.
You're dead right that she expresses things that you don't often hear expressed. But they're often thoughts or feelings widely felt. There's this quality of honesty and directness about her.
That's what I mean. I feel like she's looking for her constituency. I think there are people who think like that, but they're not necessarily SNP voters at the moment.
Yeah.
So she's a slightly different brand. And, you know, would do well if she was leading a party. I'm just not sure if this is the party for her or if the SNP is due a massive change.
A good time for her.
And that's that, I suppose, is the challenge, isn't it? Is that she might agree with them on the question of independence. But if the party has moved as far as it has to the left on...
That's the problem with having independence as your guiding light.
Yeah.
Actually, everything else can be so completely different. You know, I mean, it was hijacked by Nicola Sturgeon and turned into a very left-wing party. You know, before that, it hadn't always been. You know, you'd had that sort of brand of tartan Tory who was basically a Tory but wanted independence. I don't think they feel necessarily at home in the SNP at the moment.
You get the feeling that she wouldn't, Kate Forbes, wouldn't bang on about independence quite as much as the others and would bang on a bit more about competence. But I've spoken to a couple of supporters of hers who are not sure this is the right time for her to become leader of the party. Either best not to stand, or if stand, best to lose again narrowly.
That's interesting.
Because they're in for a really rough ride and bad election results.
The parallels with what's happened in Westminster, and that just the very act of changing leader again does cause you damage. It doesn't matter who it is. And then the act of having to clear up from the last two's, you know, problems.
But also, I mean, I think Matthew's right. If she's a serious potential leader, you don't want to come in at a time where the party's about to be decimated at an election. Mm. It's too late to turn anything around. Whereas with the Tories, you've got that odd moment where I think a lot of them are so worried about losing their seats at the election that it's worth being Prime Minister for a couple of months. You know, it's worth being the Lady Jane Grey, the Liz Truss of politics, yeah, because you'll still get maybe a book deal, a pretty bad one, and maybe a speaking gig or two in America if you get to say you're a Prime Minister for 3 months. But you know, if you're Kate Forbes and you seriously want to lead a party and you want to be a serious politician, would you want to become leader just as the party's about to be decimated and you become the person associated with that loss?
And I suppose that's the thing, is that, you know, just getting Prime Minister, First Minister on your CV is one thing. Actually, if you think you're the person who can break up a country
differently
and be the person who delivers that, that's an enormous challenge. Well, let's move on. Before we do, we've had a message from Mark in Tiverton. This is sounding very sexist. Why don't you or Matthew cook a cake and bring it in?
Please.
I can't. I can't cook at all.
Matthew, shall we make one together? Shall we go baking?
Will you take the lead?
I can make a cake. Or I can do... Well, I make a lovely quiche. Would you take a quiche?
I think we'd take a quiche.
Well, okay. I'll do that 1 week.
I could buy some Krispy Kreme donuts. Other brands
Matthew,
are available.
I'm going to teach you to bake a cake.
I don't think that counts. That's good social material. Can you film it for the socials? we'll definitely take that. Right, okay, I've committed. I'm going to bring in a quiche 1 week. Let's turn our attention to, because I was really keen to get your take on this, because people say they hate all the yaboo of Westminster and PMQs and all that, and other people say they like it. And as someone who's been there and sat there and probably made some noise, I want to get your take on this. This was the Commons Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, yesterday telling off MPs during PMQs.
Crystal clear. There's one party that's going to deliver tax cuts for working Britain, and it's the Conservative Party.
But that's a long ramble. Whoever's.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Banging the furniture, we'll have to pay for a few damages. Can we have less of it? We are not at the sixth form, no. Come on,
So the most notable is that Lindsay Hoyle seems to have got his mojo back after a few weeks piping down. I hadn't really noticed someone doing the... they normally save that for the 1922 committee.
Yeah, well, you've got tables in the 1922 committee, so it's quite easy to bang them. I'm not quite... I'm just picturing myself back on the back benches and trying to think what I would bang. It's a bit like a church.
I was going to say. What were you banging on the back benches, Matthew?
Well, there's a sort of pew in front of you, so I suppose you could hurt your hand if you hit it too hard.
You do get in some sort of venues, people would do that with their feet. You get
that's
a bit
true.
Of that. When I've been to the X Factor,
that's
finals,
when you've got a glass of champagne in your hand.
Yes, exactly.
So you have to stamp your feet.
Yeah.
Getting so elite.
I was going to say, you've done this before.
Is it getting worse, Matthew? Take us back to when you were there in the 80s.
No, it was always like that. In fact, I was advised to listen to PMQs as an example of particularly disorderly day. It wasn't particularly disorderly. It's always like that. And it's almost part of the speaker's ceremonial routine to shout, order, order. Remember, John Bercow was always doing it. And I can even remember Mr. Speaker Thomas shouting himself hoarse. When you're... It's hard to explain this in a way that I think listeners would understand or sympathise with, but when you're in it and everybody is shouting and there really is a sort of gladiatorial contest between two people and you're on the side of one of them and other people are on the side of the other, it's probably like a football match. It is very hard not just to get carried away and start shouting yourself. I'm sure I have. It's dreadful.
And what is the art of doing it? Because there's an art to doing it and not being spotted by the speaker.
Yes.
Were you a particularly noisy?
No, I wasn't particularly noisy, and I was never one of those people kind of in the foreground. There are certainly people... Well, the first art, of course, is not to sit anywhere near the speaker.
Yeah.
So sit as far away as you can from the speaker and try not to move your mouth, I suppose, would be. So you just go... Yeah. Ah, 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 like that.
Like when people at school would just start humming.
Yes, yes.
And the teacher wouldn't know. It's just going...
They can't tell it's you. Is it harder with cameras? Has that changed?
What, like VAR?
Well, like VAR, but well, you know, now that it's all televised...
People thought it, that the cameras would civilise people, but it didn't make any difference at all, as far as I can remember.
Yeah, try civilising Westminster.
What do you think, Manvin? Is it all... Because whenever people say... It's a bit like when people say they just want good news. Well, they don't want good news at all. It's just a thing for people to say. But people say they don't want the Yarboo.
Yeah, this is like Cameron coming in and saying we're done with Punch and Judy politics. Nobody ever is. Politics gets even duller when people are done with Punch and Judy politics and doesn't last for very long. I think the reason it sort of sounded kind of loud and unruly yesterday was because we've had a quieter few weeks and it just had that... I thought the speaker was onto something with the sixth form. It just felt like, you know, the last day of term. And it feels a bit like Parliament has slightly run out of... They feel like it should be the last day of term. Everyone's waiting for the election.
Yeah.
There's no sense of this is business as usual anymore. This is all... Everyone's a little bit demob happy. They're planning their life after the election.
And it's all a bit election slogans rather than interrogating there's no policy or ideas.
Because, you know, it was very lively around, say, the Brexit debates. But again, there was an issue there.
Yeah.
This is kind of... The lack of an issue is making them quite... It's all quite febrile because there's nothing to be talking about.
Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer were both talking demonstrable rubbish. So they were talking about national insurance. The Tories have not said where they're going to get the money to cut national insurance. And Keir Starmer was suggesting that it was all going to come from cuts to public services. But the fact is, what you have to do is cut... abolish national insurance and put a couple of pence onto income tax.
Yeah. And then there's winners and losers and all that. Now, let's turn our attention to... if you thought some of our chats were shallow, do you trust attractive politicians more or less ugly than other ones? Now, Matthew, explain, first of all, why you've been right about this. Because of Pedro Sanchez, the Spanish Prime Minister.
El Guapo, yes. He is... was, but still is to some degree, really strikingly good-looking. And everybody calls him El Guapo, which means the good-looking one, the pretty boy, whatever. And he's in an awful lot of trouble and seems to have got himself into quite a mess. And I just have observed that very good-looking men can't really handle it. Once they meet any kind of opposition, they don't really know what to do because everyone has always admired them and their mothers have told them how good-looking they are. My mother, who was the sweetest person, completely uncharacteristically, once said to me, you're not bad-looking, but your looks are never going to be your fortune, she said to me.
To you?
Yes.
Wow. So,
you try harder when you're not particularly good-looking.
Oh, I see.
I think women, for some reason... are able to absorb the idea that one should be beautiful and useful at the same time. I think men, once they realise they're beautiful, don't feel the need to be useful anymore.
I'll get your take on it in a moment, Manvi, but we've got Paddy Ross, who's an associate professor of psychology at Durham University. Hello, Paddy.
Hello, Matt. How's it going?
Am I good? Is there anything in this that Matthew, this theory that Matthew's developed?
Yes, there is. There's lots of research to say that... attractive people, we assume that they possess sort of more socially desirable skills than other people. We inherently trust attractive faces. And there's an effect called the halo effect, which is where you sort of, you initially pick someone who's, say, more attractive, and they can do a lot of things that are unattractive.
Can you?
But you'll still pick them for things. There's a fun study where they got people to play an investment game, and you picked your partner based on how attractive they were. And even when they started to lose all of your money, you still wanted to pick them to play with the most attractive person. So we seem to really rely on attractiveness as a signal of trustworthiness. So Matthew's position of being inherently skeptical about that is a pretty good position to take.
Yeah. What do you think, Manvin?
I think Matthew's onto something. It's exactly that thing of having always got your way. It just means you're less likely to have developed, A, the resilience that you need as a politician, which is why we now have the Spanish Prime Minister disappearing for about 5 days and threatening to resign because people are looking into his wife's accounts. But, you know, there's that sort of sense of the outrage that somebody's looking, you know, at me in a negative way and not knowing how to cope. But also there is the sense that they don't have to develop other parts of their personality.
Yes.
And that might be wit, it might be academic ability, because that, you know, they get the rewards regardless. But also I think it's something about a lot of your values come from empathy and understanding how it is, you know, not, you know, to go through something difficult.
Yeah.
And they just, you know, by its very nature, something they don't have as much experience
if
of.
If you can charm your way through
if you can charm
situation.
Your way through everything, yeah, yeah. You find it harder to empathise with people who can't, or people who are downtrodden.
We've all had it much harder, haven't we, Matthew?
great remark by PJ O'Rourke. It's always tempting to impute unlikely virtues to the cute.
Like
never
that.
A truer line was delivered.
Now, Paddy, there's no reason why you'll know the answer to this, because we've only just discovered it. But is there I've noticed that you're more John Swinney in the hair department. Is there any issue about boldness in politics?
I think the last time I was on, I did have my hair, and now I do not. Maybe I'm less trustworthy now than I'm on the second time.
Less likely to be elected, we think.
Yes, so we were looking at, so John Swinney just announced he's running for leader. He's bold. We were trying to think of another successful bold politician. William Hagan and Neil Kinnock obviously led their parties but didn't win. Is there anything about hair that plays into that?
Off the top of my bald head, there could be. There's a trope, isn't there, in movies, for instance, where the chiseled hero has some luscious black hair, like Superman or James Bond or something. The villain, the untrustworthy one, the Lex Luthor or the Blofeld, has some kind of deformity, has a beard, is bald. There's something, yes, I think, Dean, because it's not the average. So what we find attractive is actually the average face. So I don't mean the so-so in attractiveness ratings, but if you took the mean of everyone's face in the UK, anything as close to the mean as we can get, people find more attractive. And bald heads, I guess, don't tend to be in that category.
I feel like I've really learned something. It's genuinely fascinating what that means for John Swinney. I'm not totally sure. Paddy, really good to speak to you. Thanks so much for coming back.
Yes,
Paddy Ross there,
Professor
of Psychology at Durham University.
Manveen Varna and Matthew Powers there. And of course, you can catch Manveen on the Story podcast, wherever you're listening to this, and read Matthew in the Times of your week with your subscription. Up next, we're heading back to 1979. How did Margaret Thatcher win? It's Hello from the Other Side.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Thing.
In the past half century, just three people have been successful in making the leap from leader of the opposition to prime minister. Most recently, David Cameron. Before him, Tony Blair. And exactly 45 years ago this week, one of them crossed the threshold of Downing Street. Today, we look at the people, the politics, the policies which helped Margaret Thatcher win from opposition, speaking to the people who were there with her along the way. This is the story of how to win from the other side.
Hello from the other side.
I don't think there will be a woman prime minister in my lifetime.
I didn't want Margaret as leader.
She wasn't at all good in the House of Commons when she was leader of the opposition.
There was a lot of public school snobbery.
None of this protesting, you know, joining feminist marches, burning your bras or something. That wasn't her style.
The first interview I did with her, I wanted to tape record it.
No tape recorders, Fred, she said.
Her voice was too high, perhaps partly because people were prejudiced against a woman's voice.
This was the new Mrs. Thatcher, who was going to be much more gentle and friendly.
I was the first person to be able to turn around and say, Margaret, congratulations, you've won the Prime Minister.
Where there is discord, may we bring harmony.
50 years ago, there were two general elections, and Ted Heath lost them both in February 1974 and again in October. But still, he refused to quit until early in 1975, when Margaret Thatcher, a 49-year-old mother of twins, took the unusual step of challenging Heath for the leadership. She didn't want to, but she looked around and grew impatient at the reluctance or incompetence of those around her, as Ken Clark remembers.
Ted would not step down. Ted had lost the election, he lost the support of the party, but they were all loyal to him. Margaret backed a man called Keith Joseph, who was a brilliant right-wing intellectual, a very nice man indeed. He couldn't run a Welk stall. She supported him because of his views, and Margaret only stood because nobody else would. She didn't expect to win. She never had expected to be Prime Minister. She, of course, did amazingly well, because a huge proportion of the party had decided we had to change. I voted for Ted, actually, again out of loyalty, having been in his government, been a Heathite, but my personal view was he should have stepped down. But I didn't want Margaret as leader.
Well, she unexpectedly beat Ted Heath in the first round of voting and then triumphed fully in the second. The Oxford-educated chemist and lawyer had been an MP for two decades before she became Tory leader. Most famously and infamously, his education secretary was dubbed Thatcher Milk Snatcher. For her family, husband Dennis and children Mark and Carol, it wasn't always easy, as Carol remembers.
When I was a student, a law student, she was Secretary of State for Education.
And this was definitely tricky because students on the whole don't like the holder of that job, and she was no exception. So my colleagues at London University were saying, OK, we're going off to demonstrate against your mum.
It's important to remember that the Margaret Thatcher of 1975 was very different to that in 1979 or even 1990. Charles Moore wrote the three-volume authorised biography of her life.
I think it's always very important with Mrs. Thatcher to recognise what a strong ego she had right from her earliest days. So in some sense, she always felt some destiny. But because she was lower middle class, and above all, because she was a woman, she took absolutely nothing for granted, and she had no sense of entitlement. So she didn't think, you know, I'm owed this. She thought I had to earn every single bit of it. And therefore, I think it would, though she would never quite admit this, I think she was looking out for this opportunity all the time, but she was gaining in confidence, both intellectual and political, as time went on.
Jonathan Aitken had worked with Margaret Thatcher in the 1960s, even at one stage dated her daughter, Carol.
She was very awkward with a microphone, with her hats. She wasn't a person you would have taken a 100-to-1 bet on for being a future Tory leader.
In fact, among those who doubted her ability to reach the top was Margaret Thatcher herself. In interviews in the 1960s, she'd say things like she'd love to be Chancellor of the Exchequer, as if that were her highest ambition. Here she was on the BBC's Val Meets the VIPs in March 1973, just 2 years before she became Tory leader.
I don't think that there will be a woman Prime Minister in my lifetime. And I don't think it depends on so much whether it's a man prime minister or a woman prime minister as whether that person is the right person for the job at that time.
Matthew Powys was an aspiring Tory MP who got a job working as the new Tory leader's correspondence clerk.
It was like a test pad for something that had never been tried before. And my impression, I was only a clerk under the stairs, so to speak, but I was in her office. My impression of those years in opposition was that her real opposition was not coming at that time from the Labour Party, but it was coming from her own party. There was a substantial minority of her party, including a lot of her cabinet colleagues, who didn't really think, A, that a woman could be leader of the Conservative Party, and B, that even if she could, Margaret Thatcher wasn't the right woman. There was a lot of snobbery. There was a lot of public school snobbery towards her public school boys who thought that she was a rather common grammar school girl. And you just felt it in the air. And you felt under siege in Margaret Thatcher's office in opposition. And we were under siege not really from the Labour Party or the media, who found her very interesting. We were under siege from the party itself.
In those early days, she was, bluntly, not very good, struggling to establish her authority as leader, and the bare pit of Parliament appeared to overwhelm her. Jonathan Aitken watched from the back benches.
She wasn't at all good in the House of Commons when she was leader of the opposition. Callaghan, frankly, outmanoeuvred her and patronised her.
Yet on she battled. Her determination to take nothing for granted eventually impressed some of the traditional Conservative old guard. In return, she flattered them and played up her femininity. Charles Moore again.
She absolutely did not want to be like a man, but what she saw was that the apparent disadvantage of being a woman could be, as we would now say, weaponized into tremendous advantage because it was different. So she could say, look, these men, they've run the country and they've got it all wrong. And we women, we understand. So, for example, everything about inflation and budgets, she would say, we run a weekly budget. We're housewives. Of course, people, again, don't talk like that now, but that was very, very powerful. Yeah.
Carol Thatcher says her mother broke the mould by being a woman in a man's world.
She was a trailblazer, but by example, Matt, none of this protesting, you know, joining feminist marches, burning your bras or something. That wasn't her style. Her message was, I've got here, so can you.
She was also paid a huge compliment and done a huge favour when, in 1976, the Soviet Army journal, The Red Star, called her the Iron Lady, an epithet which she later, albeit reluctantly, embraced.
I stand before you tonight in my Red Star chiffon evening gown. (Laughs) face softly made up and my fair hair gently waved. The Iron Lady of the Western World.
Not that Margaret Thatcher relished her relationship with the media back home. Fred Emery was political editor of The Times.
She was always difficult, you know, with journalists. The first interview I did with her, I wanted to tape record it to make sure I really got it down perfectly. No tape recorders, Fred, she said.
Peter Jay was the first presenter of ITV's Weekend World.
The thing I chiefly remember about interviewing her, I think it was at that time, was that she was accompanied by what I regard as a noxious little sort of PR man. And I remember him appearing in the studio and trying to behave as though he was some great power in the land and trying to give orders to the studio crew how his minister should be lit and seated and how she should look and fussing about things which I consider to be none of his business.
Away from the cameras, she focused on developing a new Tory creed, ideas formed as a young woman. She'd pulled herself up by her bootstraps. Why couldn't everyone else? Was shaped into an ideology with the help of those closest to her, advocating not equality, but what she called equality of opportunity. This was a platform which would later become known as Thatcherism, a smaller state, deregulation, privatisation, and the dismantling of the union power which had held hostage the Labour governments of Harold Wilson and James Callaghan. David Howell was a shadow minister and close advisor to Margaret Thatcher.
I remember Margaret Thatcher saying to me in early days, I never want to be a cult, I never want to be an ism. Because later on, I think dazzled by the success of her, the way she was seen in public opinion, she rather, as it were, bowed to her own image.
Putting that vision into words was not always easy. Adam Ridley was an economist who became head of the Conservative Research Department. Together with the playwright Ronnie Miller and Chris Patton, who would go on to serve in the cabinet, he helped write her big speeches, including make-or-break addresses to the annual Tory party conference.
I think she, particularly the first two or three, was really quite nervous. I mean, her position in the party was not very strong, though she'd won the leadership. And therefore, she felt uneasy. She received from Chris and me, and shortly after that, one or two others, bits of material more or less put together, and she received a speech plan more or less. And she would then say at the beginning of our first collective meeting, this just won't do. It's too ghastly, you know. And I've just had to put them all out. And she would have all the way down the room, 50 or 100 typescript pages. She said, I think we've got to throw that bit out. And I think that, I mean, it'd completely rewrite from that. And there's a marvellous Kipling poem we can put in there. And so we would then dutifully take it away and we would work on some bits as she'd wanted and work on others as we did. And gradually, we allowed her to discover where it wasn't working and conversely allowed her to see where we were seeing things that were working. And then we had as our, if you like, special, not weapon exactly, but special extra assister, Ronnie Miller, the playwright. Now, he was absolutely brilliant at helping tighten up and sharpen up and lively up the language.
Not that she always understood what she was saying. David Howell.
I used to put jokes into her speeches. I was the chief of her speechwriting team, which was a difficult job. Quite often she didn't understand the jokes and got them crossed out because that was not her humour.
These speeches were not froth in PR. The act of writing them helped to clarify and articulate the thinking which would eventually go into the manifesto. By 1978, they thought they were ready. They needed to be. When the Lib Lab Pact ended, rumours swirled that James Callaghan would go to the country in the autumn, but he bottled it.
I shall not be calling for a general election at this time. Instead, I ask every one of you to carry on with the task of consolidating the improvement now taking place in our country's position. Let's see it through together.
I think he's made a mistake, and I think his decision is really against the nation's best interests. He's lost his majority, and when that happens, I think you lose the authority to govern.
Adam Ridley remembers it well.
In early 78, we spent a very long weekend drafting a first manifesto, and therefore we took it to Shadow Cabinet, and they said, this is a lovely piece of work, but it's far, far, far too long. Let's say it's 15,000 words. And that then went through a very entertaining process. The Shadow Cabinet, having debated the specifics, they said, what I think, Margaret, really what we need is a short manifesto, just the... picked up a piece of paper, the size of a postcard. At which point another member of the Shadow Cabinet said, not a postcard, a postage stamp. So we asked them, right, what do you want to cut and what else do you want to put in? All we got was suggestions of massive extra additions, and not one single person suggested any serious reduction.
Then the SNP withdrew their support for the Labour government, and Margaret Thatcher spotted her opportunity. On Wednesday, March the 28th, 1979, she tabled a motion of no confidence in the government.
The ayes to the right, 311. The noes to the left, 310. So the ayes have it.
Tomorrow, I shall propose to Her Majesty that this House be dissolved, that Parliament be dissolved, as soon as essential business can be cleared up. And I will then announce the date of dissolution, the date of the election, and the date of meeting of the new Parliament.
Before she could bring about her plan to change the country, Margaret Thatcher herself had undergone something of a transformation, as her biographer Charles Moore explains.
There was a curious humility about Mrs. Thatcher. In some ways, she was very arrogant on certain issues and very dismissive of others and so on. But if she knew she didn't know about something, she didn't pretend that she did. She greatly respected advertising men because they understood a whole load of things that she didn't. She essentially wanted to learn from them. So Gordon Rees, for example, who was her closest advisor, probably in a personal sense, she'd take it from him all the time about her hair, her teeth, her voice, her clothes. The words she used all had to change, but they had to change not in order to conceal the reality, but to, as it were, bring it out, to get all the extraneous stuff out of the way and make it as simple and clear and attractive as possible.
Since her days as education secretary, her spin doctor, Gordon Rees, a cigar-chomping TV producer turned Tory PR man, had been carrying out polling after each of her interviews and appearances to find out what people thought of her. And he knew the voice was a problem.
Oh, very much so. I've done a good deal of other speaking, but speaking in the House of Commons is quite different. It's a unique experience.
The Lincolnshire schoolgirl had picked up bad habits at Oxford, poshing it up to fit in, as many do at university. A chance encounter on a train from Brighton to London saw Gordon Rees air his concerns to Laurence Olivier, the legendary actor who's by now running the National Theatre. He offered the services of the theatre's voice coach, Kate Fleming. I went to the National Theatre archive and saw the bills for her private lessons, dozens in total, which lasted from 1972, well into her time as leader of the opposition. Charles Moore again.
Her voice was too high. It was perhaps partly because people were prejudiced against a woman's voice. But actually, if you listen to it in the 60s, it was too high. That somehow interfered with its audibility and its communicative power. And if she could get a bit more depth into it without pretending to be a man, you know, it sounded somewhat artificial, perhaps, and some people didn't like that, but it somehow also gave her more gravitas.
Journalists on the receiving end of this new and improved voice included the BBC's Michael Cockrell.
I remember doing an interview with Mrs. Thatcher during the 1979 election, and so this was the new Mrs. Thatcher, who was going to be much more gentle and friendly. I said to Mrs. Thatcher, I've been following you during this election. There sometimes seem to me to be two Mrs. Thatchers, the one on the platform full of passionate rhetoric and the one on the floors in the street or in the factories that you visit, who are endlessly interested in the minutiae of people's lives. How many Mrs. Thatchers are there? And she said, oh, three at least. And she had this new voice that she'd been taught by the voice coach in the National Theatre, so it was a much deeper voice. She said, oh, there are three at least. I said, what are the three? She said, there's the intellectual one, there's the intuitive one, and there's the one at home.
By some estimations, her voice was now 46 hertz lower, putting her halfway between the average female and male voice. The Conservatives also brought in ad men from Saatchi & Saatchi, who in expectation of the election in 1978 devised the now famous Labour Isn't Working poster. The plan had been for 100 people to appear in it, but only around 20 members of the Hendon Young Conservatives turned up at a park in North London. So they laid out a rope on the ground and photographed them multiple times. Maurice Sarchi told me the impact of his work for Thatcher's Tories.
Our most famous work, whether it's in print or in television, all this didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of an understanding that you only need to know two sentences to understand everything there is to know about British politics. Labour is caring but incompetent. Conservatives are efficient but cruel. Having understood those two sentences, it is the job of the leader at election time to point out the defects in the opponent's position. You're in the boxing ring. Your opponent has just landed a blow on your face. There is only one thing to do now, which is to land a blow on your opponent's chin, which knocks him out.
With the benefit of hindsight, it might seem that Margaret Thatcher's victory in 1979 was an inevitability. But through much of the late 1970s, the polls between Labour and the Conservatives were close, really close. Here's David Howell.
I can remember when we went to have made a speech in Bolton. I accompanied Mrs. Thatcher on all these trips. And the Evening Standard came in with a poll saying that Labour had moved 2 or 3 points ahead, I think. And there was, you know, just a hush fell on the company. And some of our experts began saying Mrs. Thatcher should do this instead of that, and she was too sharp, or she was too this, that. And this rather undermined Mrs. Thatcher. Her daughter, Carol, put her arm around her and said, "Why are you being so unfair to Mummy? She's doing..." And Margaret Thatcher herself said, "I thought I was doing rather well."
Then came the winter of discontent. The Labour government imposed wage caps to curb inflation, triggering a wave of strikes, transport at a standstill, rubbish piling up in the streets. And as the 1979 election approached, divisions over how to shape the Tory campaign emerged. Some felt, and the polls bore this out, that if it was a presidential-style runoff between the two main leaders, Callaghan would win because he was an avuncular type. He was more experienced and less likely to startle the horses. But alongside this, the prospect of the first female prime minister also brought the shock of the new, which the Tories wanted to harness. Margaret Thatcher herself was pushing hard on winning the battle of ideas, warning that socialism was dangerous, and in her view, conservatism was the only alternative.
We're coming to the moment of decision. As the tumult and the shouting of the last few weeks die away, and you sit at home wondering what to do on Thursday, I can well imagine you saying to yourselves, if only the politicians would be quiet. If only we could sit peacefully for a few minutes and think about our country and its future and the decision you are asking us to make.
When Margaret Thatcher moved against Ted Heath in 1975, the Tories were 14 points behind Labour in the polls. By the time of the 1979 election, when James Callaghan had replaced Howard Wilson as Labour Prime Minister, the Tories were comfortably ahead, achieving a swing of 5.2% at the ballot box and winning with a 44-seat majority. With her at her own count in Finchley on election night was Michael Dobbs, who would go on to turn his experience of real political drama into the hit House of Cards series.
I was her... It's called special duties, which I think meant almost anything that was required. This is before computers. I had to carry around two huge suitcases filled with everything that I thought she might want to know on tour or for her parliamentary appearances for Prime Minister's Question Time. And I've been doing that for several years. So 79 election campaign, I was on the bus, I went around with her everywhere.
And your suitcases?
With my suitcases, indeed, and my toothbrush. And I was with her on the night of the actual poll. So I was with her in Finchley, at Barnet Town Hall, where the Finchley count took place, while she was waiting for her own declaration. There were five of us. There was Margaret, there was Dennis, there was a secretary, there was a special branch guy, there was me. She was waiting rather nervously for her declaration of her own result. I was monitoring the results as they were coming through. The picture became very clear pretty early, and for what it's worth, I was the first person to be able to turn around and say, "Margaret, congratulations, you've won." your Prime Minister.
How does she react to that? What goes through the mind of someone? You know, there's a difference between thinking you're going to win and actually getting the news that you have.
There was a significant pause as she reflected on this, and then she turned to me, and in a very controlled fashion, she said, "We shall see. We shall see."
Arriving in Downing Street the morning after the election, with crowds cheering in the street, with a little help from Ronnie Miller, she quoted Francis of Assisi.
"Where there is discord, may we bring harmony. Where there is error, may we bring truth. Where there is doubt, may we bring faith. And where there is despair, may we bring hope."
The reason she was saying that was because of the tremendous divisions in society caused by these endless strikes.
Here's her biographer, Charles Moore, again.
So when she came in 1979, there were 29 million working days lost to strikes in that year. And when she left office, there was, I think, about 2 million or less days lost to strike 11 years later. So massive change. And in the industrial sphere, therefore, much greater working harmony by the end. And so, funnily enough, this great confrontationalist did bring about a harmony in certain ways. So she's coming in 1979 saying, on the one hand, we've got to have a hell of a fight on our hands to get Britain right. And on the other hand, we're going to stop these dreadful quarrels.
While the 1979 election debate might have been over, the national quarrel was only just beginning. Although that is another story. And it would be another 18 years before a leader of the opposition would go on to become Prime Minister, winning from the other side. That was the story of how Margaret Thatcher became one of only three people in the last half century to go from being leader of the opposition to Prime Minister. Obviously, all eyes on whether or not Keir Starmer can do the same. Let me know what you think about this or any other episode of Politics at the Boyne Bits. You can email me, matt@times.radio. But for now, from me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.